From News Talk 580 KMJ, this is the Maddie Report, Valley Views Edition. Here is Mark Kepler.
This week on the Maddie Report, Valley Views Edition.
Signed by then-Governor Reagan in 1970, the California Environmental Quality Act, or CEQA, is generally recognized as the strongest state environmental law in the nation. Under CEQA, cities and counties must identify the environmental effects, if any, of most major project proposals and determine whether a full-blown environmental impact report, or EIR, is required to offset any potential harm. If there are environmental impacts, a project must offer a way to mitigate those impacts on such things as air quality, water, traffic, noise, and aesthetics. While this can be done many ways, such as adding traffic lanes, providing open space, contributing to a sewer plant expansion, or downsizing the project, the bottom line is that it adds cost to projects. Proponents of CEQA say that such public input and mitigation is necessary. Proponents of reforming CEQA say that the CEQA process is being abused by businesses seeking to undermine competitors, unions seeking to exert pressure on non-union businesses, and NIMBYs who use it to delay or kill products they don't like. Does CEQA need reform? We'll ask Sacramento attorney Tina Thomas, a CEQA expert and author of A Guide to the California Environmental Quality Act, Alan Zarenberg, the CEO of the California Chamber of Commerce, and Bruce Resnick, Executive Director of the California Planning and Conservation League.
We'll also hear from Judy Sly of the Modesto Bee, Sarah Hedgebeth Harris, a Fresno land use attorney, and Calvin Steed, an environmental law attorney from Bakersfield.
Reforming CEQA, trying not to throw the baby out with the bathwater.
From Fresno, the Maddie Report, with Executive Director of the Maddie Institute, Mark Kepler.
Welcome. The California Environmental Quality Act, or CEQA, was signed by Ronald Reagan in 1970 when he was governor, and it's been hailed by environmentalists as a key defense against urban sprawl. Developers and business leaders, on the other hand, often complain that the law results in excessive red tape and drives up construction costs unnecessarily. So what is CEQA, and what are the issues? Our first guest is Sacramento attorney Tina Thomas, who literally wrote the book on CEQA, A Guide to the California Environmental Quality Act, and we're very delighted to have her with us today. So let's start getting into the weeds here about CEQA. Can you briefly describe what CEQA is and why it was enacted?
Sure. CEQA is a very important statute. It was enacted, as you said, in 1970 for the purpose of protecting the natural resources of the state of California, a very important goal. Unfortunately, over the years, it's devolved into something a little bit different. It's often used by competitors. It's often used by NIMBYs and those who don't want not-in-my-backyard folks, and often used by labor organizations to get project labor agreements. So its original purpose is still a great purpose, and it does great things.
You know, it's interesting you say that. Right now, there is a discussion about outsourcing of garbage services in the city of Fresno, and one of the things that the opponents to the outsourcing are using is CEQA.
Correct. You'll often see competitors using CEQA against each other in the waste industry, gas stations, one big box against another big box. It's not uncommon, but it wasn't the original purpose of the statute.
Well, what projects are subject to CEQA?
So any project that is discretionary has to comply with CEQA. So discretionary means anytime an agency, either a city, a county, a special district, an agency of the state, has to exercise judgment. So if there's not a set of rules by which they must apply, for example, going to get a building permit, you know you have to do certain things. That's a ministerial act, not subject to CEQA. Anything that requires any judgment or discretion is a project under CEQA.
What's exempt from CEQA requirements?
There are two categories of exempt projects, those that are created by the resources agencies, and they're anything from a project that has a beneficial impact to the environment to the Olympic Games. They could be anything in that range. There are those statutory exemptions that are created by the legislature, such as we all know about the NFL stadium in L.A.
Yeah.
Correct. So there's different kinds, and those are exemptions that are created either by the agency or by the legislature.
Okay, so why don't you, and this is going to be difficult, but why don't you walk us through the CEQA process?
Sure. So if you're a city, I'll just take a city as an example, who has a project that's been proposed in their jurisdiction, perhaps it's a residential project. They, at that point, do what's called an initial study and determine what are the potential environmental impacts of the project. If they can reduce all those impacts to less than significant, they can do a negative declaration.
Referred to as a neg deck.
Correct, a neg deck in the parlance. Or if they cannot reduce those impacts to less than significant, they prepare an environmental impact report, which is a longer form, requires public review periods and a second sort of iteration, which is a response to comments. So it's just a longer process.
So then there are the lawsuits. So again, let's talk about what prompts the lawsuits. I mean, part of it might be that people feel that there really is an environmental impact here that's not being addressed. But what other things prompt the lawsuits that you've seen?
Sure. There are very legitimate lawsuits that are brought by legitimate environmental organizations that make a lot of sense. And they do things that make a project better. And those are good things. Nobody's trying to stop those things. But there are a lot of abuses that are in the CEQA process, such as we talked about, competitors and NIMBYs. And what we found in recent research that we've done is that 61% of the lawsuits are against good infill projects, or against infill projects. So we're
Describe an infill project just in case our audience
So an infill
understand.
Project would be a project within an existing city that's more than likely consistent with its general plan and its community plan.
Okay, so you're seeing lawsuits there as well?
Correct. We're seeing a lot of lawsuits against infill because people don't want more density close to their homes.
We're talking with CEQA expert and Sacramento attorney Tina Thomas about the California Environmental Quality Act, or CEQA. You know, California's business community has stated that CEQA is detrimental to the economic development of the state. What are their concerns?
Well, I think that there's a fairly significant concern that the statute is so complicated and so uncertain that a lot of people won't come to the state of California and invest in the state of California because of that statute. There's also the concern that these are very lengthy, expensive documents that have to be prepared with expensive mitigation associated with them. But probably the biggest concern is the unpredictability of litigation. If, in fact, you go through a very long environmental impact reporting process and you are sued, you're going to probably be in litigation for 3 or 4 years. It's going to be very expensive. You probably cannot get a loan there, get a loan on the project. So you're going to be in a situation where the project is essentially suspended until the conclusion of the litigation.
Well, let's talk about this issue of unpredictability. Is that because the regulations and the law are vague? Or is it because local jurisdictions have their own interpretation of what constitutes a significant environmental impact or an appropriate mitigation measure?
Well, local jurisdictions do have a lot of deference to adopt their own significance thresholds. And I think most of the regulated community, when they go into a jurisdiction, they know what those standards are, and that's a good thing because they can follow those standards. Where it gets a little bit more unpredictable is that we have all these statutes that have been approved by the legislature that create standards. And in many instances, we want to be able to rely upon those and conclude that the impact is less than significant. Makes a lot of sense. It provides clarity, consistency, and predictability. But we end up in litigation a lot of times because opponents believe that you need to do more than what the legislature has asked you to do. And that's where there gets to be a lot of confusion, a lot of uncertainty, and again, a lot of just time loss related to job generating projects in the state of California.
You know, in 2006, the legislature passed and Governor Schwarzenegger signed AB 32, which promised to return to 1990 greenhouse gas emission levels by 2020. How has that complicated the CEQA process?
Actually, AB 32, a very important statute, you know, that the environmental groups, you know, hailed as something that was, you know, just a cutting-edge statute in the United States. That 2020 standard was, if we could have relied upon that and used that as the standard and said, we achieved that standard, that's the end of what we have to do, that would have been great. But project opponents went a little bit further and said, no, you need to do more than the 2020 standard. You need to do a 2050 standard or a 2035 standard, or in some cases, a net zero standard. So again, we lost that consistency and predictability when people went outside the bounds of what the legislature had approved.
So they're moving the goalposts.
Exactly.
Okay. There are other environmental laws besides AB 32. How is the coordination between CEQA and those other environmental regulatory processes?
Well, actually, it's not so great, Mark. We'd like to be able to rely on those statutes or on the interpretations of those statutes by agencies such as the California Air Resources Board. So if there is a series of standards related to ambient air quality, we should be able to rely on those standards because they are protective of human health, and be able to rely on water quality standards because they are protective of human health and aquatic life. But again, oftentimes the goalposts are moved.
Well, let's end with this. There's lots of concerns about the legal expenses associated with CEQA. Some say, you know, it leads to a lot of litigation. Others say that's really overblown. And they cite the statistic that only one out of 350 situations actually lead to a lawsuit. What's been your experience?
Well, the 350 number is, if you look at any agenda for a city council or a board of supervisors, pretty much everything is a discretionary project, whether it's buying a garbage truck or something as complicated as a development. So, you know, there's a lot of decisions that are made on a daily basis that are exempt or approved on neg decks that just aren't litigated. That's true.
Okay, so there's some of these,
there aren't necessarily lawsuits, but still CEQA is impacting the process.
Correct.
A lot of these decisions.
What we do know is that there's about 200 to 220 lawsuits a year. That's a lot in my book.
I'm probably in a lot of people's books. Well, I want to thank Sacramento attorney and CEQA expert Tina Thomas for joining us. The business community has long complained that CEQA stifles development and encourages frivolous lawsuits. Recently, they've had a receptive ear of the governor and key Democrats who control the state legislature. A leading spokesperson for business is our guest, Alan Zarenberg, president and CEO of the California Chamber of Commerce. Welcome to the Matty Report.
Well, thanks for having me back. It's great to be here and get a chance to talk to your viewers.
Great. Well, listen, what do you see as the biggest problems with CEQA as it currently works, and how do you think they should be addressed?
Let me first say, and I give you a little background here, it isn't just the business community. So I can recall a couple years ago, before this became an issue where Jerry Brown embraced and some other people, is I was giving a talk on the economy of California to the rural counties of California, about 33 of them who are members of this association. And I talked about some of the problems, and then I did a question and answer. And every single Q&A was really a lecture, not a question. And they were all board of supervisors and all from the rural counties. And the number one thing is, when are we going to do something about CEQA? It's killing our job growth. It's killing the ability to develop in the rural areas. And we really need jobs. So this goes well beyond the business community. This is about elected officials who really see a need to grow California, and this is a barrier.
Let me follow up on that. Folks say that when the proponents of reform argue that it's hurting economic development, they say, listen, it's not hurting economic development because, number one, economic development is doing fine on the coast, number one. Number two, that, listen, California's economic decline is because of the housing crisis or the tightness of credit or other reasons, that CEQA is really not the main driver of the economic problems in California. How would you respond to that?
Well, California is a diverse economy, diverse population, diverse industries. So there are different factors that affect different industries. But CEQA, it was clearly pointed out by the rural county supervisors in many locations that this is a barrier to development. So let's talk a little bit about what's wrong with it. And I think we can go into, you know, is this a cause and effect? You know, what's wrong with it is that it's costly and it's used for many purposes to delay projects that have nothing to do with the environment, but blame environmental problems for trying to stop a project. And these are projects, let's be clear, these are things that are going to grow California. So our population is growing 400,000 to 500,000 people a year. We have to find jobs and we have to grow. And if you can't develop, you know, somebody's going to grow somewhere else. So let's be clear about what this is about. And what the problems are with CEQA is that it's very costly. And it's very costly because it's been abused. And how has it been abused? Well, it's been abused because it goes well beyond the environmental impacts and the mitigation. So when you do an environmental impact report, you try to cover every base possible so you don't get sued. And when you just have somebody who doesn't want to see California grow or their neighborhood grow because they already have theirs and they're not concerned about what happens to the quality of life in California,
so
developing
you have these
a tax base.
Voluminous reports.
Yeah, and then people bring in lawsuits anyhow.
Let me ask you about the lawsuits. You know, one of the arguments on the pro-CEQA side, I guess, is saying, listen, the lawsuit crisis is really overblown. There aren't a lot of people that are filing lawsuits. So if most of the projects go forward without a lawsuit, you know, is that argument of legal costs, is that really an overblown argument?
No, because what you have are the lead agency that has to certify it, requires every possible mitigation under the sun to try to avoid lawsuits. So you overexpose yourself. But I think we have to step back here a little bit and say, what's the difference now and maybe 30 years ago? You know, we have dozens of new laws on the books that create environmental standards that we all have to live by. And, you know, in the whole, it's good for California. And so if a development complies with an environmental standard that was created subsequent to CEQA, whether it be greenhouse gas or land use planning or air quality, why should you still be subject to litigation over that if you've complied and relied on the government standards that they've developed with public hearings?
That's a very strong argument that people on the pro-reform side make. But could that be countered by an argument that would say, listen, yes, it's true, there are all these laws that have happened since 1970, environmental regulations and laws, but they were enacted with legislature's full knowledge that CEQA was already on the books, and therefore they passed these other environmental laws not with the intent of eliminating CEQA, but rather complementing CEQA. How would you respond to that?
They, you know, these laws were adopted to set standards, to give business and governments guidance on what the standards should be to protect our environment. You know, if you comply with those standards, you know, that's not what CEQA should be about. CEQA should be about those situations where you may not have a standard, you know, certain traffic where it has to be on a case-by-case basis, you know, certain noise. But, you know, if you have a general plan and it went through CEQA and had an environmental impact report, you comply with that, and your local air district has adopted air quality emission standards and greenhouse gas standards, and you meet all those standards, you know, when you get sued on that, those people aren't trying to change the environmental rules. They're just trying to stop the project.
Well, I want to thank Alan Zarenberg from the California Chamber of Commerce for joining us. To the environmental community, CEQA is an important, perhaps the most important, law protecting the environment. As a result, they're expressing concern over making wholesale changes to that law. One of their key spokespersons is Bruce Resnick, Executive Director of the Planning and Conservation League. Welcome to the Matty Report.
Thank you very much for having me.
So proponents argue that the CEQA process is being abused by businesses against competitors, by unions seeking to exert pressure on non-union businesses, by NIMBYs who want to kill or delay projects. Is there some need for reform?
Look, I don't think any law is sacred, and not even CEQA, although it is the foundational environmental law and something that PCL helped draft back in 1970 and have been defending in the legislature and the courts ever since. You know, the problem we have is, first of all, you got to define abuse. You know, a lot of times the other side looks at abuse as every time they just don't get their way on a project, that's abuse. You know, the reality is when most independent studies have been done, you don't actually see a lot of abuse. You see a few anecdotes on the other side. We have, you know, 75 anecdotes of good CEQA success stories, a report we did in 05 called Everyday Heroes that we're updating. So first we have to define what abuse is. The reality is, even taking all that into account, CEQA has been one of the most amended statutes. Almost 20 sections a year over the last 5 years have been amended. And the reality is we're making it more confusing. We're making it more difficult to work. And that's one of the other complaints you hear. Well, CEQA is very confusing. Well, it's confusing because we've amended it so much. So, you know, I think we need to pull back. It's been a statute that's worked really well. I think we need to explore where it can work better. But when I talk about, you know, reform, it is making it work better for better environmental outcomes, better community engagement.
Well, some folks also say, listen, CEQA adds a lot of cost to projects, and that hurts economic growth. What's your response to that?
Does CEQA add some cost? Yes. You know, I grew up, my mom used to say, you know, an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. And that's what CEQA is about. It's about looking at the, you know, taking your time, looking at the potential impacts, doing everything you can to minimize those impacts. Is that going to take a little bit longer? Yes. Is it going to cost a little bit of money? Yes. But the reality is you end up with a better outcome at the end. And I think it's a little disingenuous when folks talk about, you know, the economic climates and how much it hurts jobs. Look, why is this country in an economic mess? because we deregulated the housing industry. We deregulated Wall Street and the banking industry and basically allowed those folks to profit while everyone else paid the cost. And that's exactly what deregulation of environmental regs do. CEQA, one of the most important things it does, in addition to, you know, good green outcomes, community empowerment, informed decision making, good governance type requirements, is it forces developers to internalize the cost of their development. And if they didn't do that, you know, you're going to have those costs, but they're going to be born in dirty air and dirty water and toxic communities.
Well, what about the legal costs associated with CEQA? And you often hear the pushback from the environmental side saying, well, listen, there are not a lot of lawsuits filed.
Right.
Businesses are going to respond, well, that may be true, but the threat of a lawsuit is what's driving up legal costs. What is your response to that?
A good point, and I think we both have some solid points, but I would say it is the threat of lawsuit that often makes agencies actually comply with CEQA. You know, one of the things that we talked about, and this came up with a bill last year with 317, is, well, we want all the process of CEQA, but we don't want any enforcement. Well, what good's a law if you're not going to enforce it? I mean, the reality is you need that enforcement mechanism. And with CEQA, it is the threat of lawsuits that actually brings agencies to the table and makes sure they do their job. Because the reality is, most of the time, agencies are going to try to bend over backwards to appease, you know, a big development project, a big, you know, industrial project. And again, that's going to often benefit those companies, but at the expense of the public.
One of the more controversial proposals is this thing called standard-based approach, where they're saying, listen, if a developer meets the city plan or the county general plan or state environmental requirements, there shouldn't be a CEQA lawsuit. What's the problem with that? If they're meeting all the environmental requirements, why add CEQA on top of that?
Well, that sounds good. There's a number of problems. First of all, there's stuff that CEQA does that no other standard does. And when people talk about CEQA and they talk about the green outcomes, well, that's true. But like I said, CEQA is so much more. It really is viewed as an environmental bill of rights. It is what gives communities a voice in the decisions. It is what gives decision makers the information they need. So if you pull just the standards approach, you lose a lot of that. The second part is a lot of standards just aren't that good. A lot of general plans are 10, 20 years old. They're out of date. They don't actually provide the protection. So CEQA is really the catch-all, and it's the fabric and the foundation of law that brings those together. So, you know, the standards, like I said, it sounds good. It sounds very common sense. But a lot of really impactful projects would be getting through if you didn't have CEQA as the backstop.
What about the argument that, listen, CEQA focuses on individual projects, and that's a poor substitute for general plans that are really focused more on the cumulative or regional impacts of land use decisions?
I agree. I agree.
Okay, next question.
But the point is, if we have a problem with our land use in California, and I agree that we do, we need to do more infill and less sprawl and all that, we shouldn't be weakening the community protections that CEQA provides, which is what the response is from the other side. We should be strengthening our land use planning. And the reality is, as much as some of the folks that are looking to weaken CEQA, you know, they want to portray it as, you know, these are the green projects in the infill, it really is sort of the business as usual. It's a big industry. It's the Walmarts, it's the Chevrons, and what have you. And, you know, the reality of it is, you know, kind of, again, bending over backwards to sort of make those guys happy is really going to ultimately impact the communities. And that's particularly important in a place like Central Valley, which already bears so many impacts of air and water. And CEQA is the one thing that really empowers those communities to have a meaningful voice in the quality of their life.
Well, I want to thank Bruce Resnick from the California Planning and Conservation League, Sacramento attorney Tina Thomas, and Alan Zarenberg with the California Chamber of Commerce for joining us.
Up next, what impact will CEQA reform mean for the Valley? We'll talk to Sarah Hedgepeth Harris, a Fresno land use attorney, Calvin Steed, an environmental law attorney from Bakersfield, and Judy Sly of the Modesto Bee.
From News Talk 580 KMJ, this is the Matty Report, Valley Views Edition. Here is Mark Kepler.
Welcome back. So what about the Valley? What impacts, economic, environmental, will CEQA reform have here? We have three points of view on that question. Calvin Steed is an environmental law attorney from Bakersfield. Judy Sly is from the Modesto Bee. And Sarah Hedgepeth Harris is a Fresno land use attorney. Welcome all of you to the Matty Report Valley Views Edition. Calvin, let's start with you first. And I'm going to be a little contrarian here. I'm going to kind of flip it a little bit and say, what are some specific examples that you can cite where CEQA actually has improved the planning process?
you know, the one of my favorites is the reduction in leapfrog development. That was a big problem back in the 60s and 70s all over California. And you can still find examples of it in almost every community, in particularly along traffic corridors. And I think, I think CEQA has done a lot towards reducing that kind of problem and raising awareness of planners and city council and county supervisors regarding those kind of issues.
Okay. Sarah, what do you think? Have you seen situations where it's actually improved the process?
Well, from my perspective, and I first encountered CEQA in 1992 when I was on the 5th District Court of Appeal, and I was an attorney for the judges there, and they were just starting to do these CEQA petitions. And I think that CEQA almost always improves the planning process because it informs it. I mean, its whole purpose is to provide information to the electeds and the public regarding the impacts of development on our resources, on our natural resources, the water we drink, the air we breathe, it always enhances the process from my perspective.
From your perspective, always. Okay. Well, Judy, what about up in Modesto? Have you seen situations where CEQA's actually improved the process?
I think it generally does improve the planning process. And when you said specific examples, I'm thinking of when Kaiser wanted to build a hospital up at the north edge of Modesto a few years ago. And what they had to do was some of the most complete traffic studies that had been done for that area. And, of course, traffic equals air pollution, but traffic also equals frustration. So a lot of that stuff gets done a lot more thoroughly because of CEQA. So I think it generally improves the process.
You know, let's now talk about why people are complaining about CEQA. Where are situations that you've seen, Sarah, we're going to start with you now, where it's actually, you said it's always worked. Have you ever seen a situation where CEQA hasn't worked, where it's actually been misused for a non-environmental purpose?
Well, I think we're talking a little bit differently in terms of the language or the terms that we're using here, is that I think it's always helpful to the planning process for people to know what are the consequences of certain developments are. So in that respect, I think CEQA is helpful to the planning process. I can think of examples where there's been misuse, but it depends on how you define misuse. From my perspective, I can give an example in particular where it was misused. And there was a recent article in the Fresno Bee about a big warehouse distribution facility in Visalia, VWR. And CEQA was misused in that case because the city used a CEQA exemption for a huge warehouse facility where, you know, 18-wheelers would be driving up and down 99 and into this warehouse facility, and they identified a CEQA exemption so that they wouldn't have to do any environmental review. So this big warehouse was allowed to be constructed, and it's under operation, and there's never been a full CEQA review of the impacts of that facility on the environment. I see that as an abuse of CEQA.
That's a little bit of a flip. Normally, when people talk about abuses, they're talking about unions using it as a way to stop non-union businesses from being built, or NIMBYs, not in my backyard situations where people just don't want a project, or business competitors trying to shut down a competitor. So, Judy, you probably have more of the traditional complaint about CEQA up in Modesto. Have you seen situations up there where it's been used, CEQA's been misused?
Yes, I can think of a couple. One would be in Ceres, which has some vacant property right there off 99 at the Mitchell Road interchange. And there's a proposal for a Walmart Supercenter to go in there. That has been the two sides which are funded. One side is funded by Walmart. One side is funded by the unions and the other supermarkets. They've been fighting for over 5 years. That is vacant land. It's been sitting idle for years. And that's not an environmental conflict. That is strictly a business conflict. And CEQA has been used to hold that up. Another example, out in Patterson, there was a proposal at the former Crow's Landing Naval Air Station, and the county sought master developers. And there was always an understanding that there would be a major CEQA review, but the city of Patterson didn't like the master developer that was chosen and filed wanted the CEQA review to be done before the master developer was chosen. And in that case, it was a timing issue. It was just an effort to delay the real EIR getting done. And in fact, it ended up in court in Fresno, and that's exactly what the judge said. Of course, there will be an EIR done, but not that early in the process.
Yeah, delay is sometimes a strategy in these situations.
That's what it was.
Yeah. Calvin, what about in Bakersfield? Have you seen problems with CEQA where it's being used for a non-environmental purpose?
Well, we've had the same kinds of issues Judy mentioned about, big box centers here for actually several years. In fact, one of the major cases came out of Bakersfield involving a Walmart, one of the urban blight type cases that started a whole new area of CEQA review. So, yeah, we've seen that in particular here for quite a while, and still ongoing. Several of those Walmarts never got built, for example.
Right. Yeah, UFCW, United Food and Commercial Workers, probably were involved in that, I would guess. But anyway, let's move on to something else. You know, Valley has traditionally high unemployment rates, and some blame CEQA as causing our economic problems. Others say that other parts of the state are doing just fine while complying with CEQA, and that the main drivers of the Valley's economic woes are the housing crash and its uneducated or undereducated workforce. So the question, we'll start with you, Judy. The question is, how big a role does CEQA play in the Valley's economic situation? What do you see up there in Modesto?
I think CEQA is a factor, but not the biggest factor. This whole notion that California's environmental regulations is put a stranglehold on business, CEQA is clearly the big player in that. In our area, our undereducated workforce is a huge factor, and I think probably the bigger factor. But we do see, for instance, Hillmar Cheese, which is a major cheesemaker in just at the north edge of Merced County, moved to Texas with his second facility, and environmental issues were clearly a concern there.
Right, and environmental issues are a little bit different in Texas. Calvin, what about down in Bakersfield? Do you think our economic problems or the economic problems in Bakersfield are because of CEQA or because of some other reason, like housing or workforce?
The latter. CEQA, frankly, has been around for going on 40 years, I think. And
it was actually signed by Ronald Reagan, which is kind of interesting.
Its 40th anniversary was last year.
Yeah.
Pardon me?
Yeah, its 40th anniversary was last year. It's I think a lot of people will be surprised that when he was governor, he signed that law. But
right.
In any event,
so it's been around a long time, and there was initially a lot of reaction to it. But I think most businesses that are in California, Kern County, whatever, and want to stay here and continue to do business here have learned to go along to get along. So I don't think CEQA was the problem. I know here in Bakersfield in particular, we have workforce education issues that are huge, and problematic. And the housing slump, even though housing has come back here, it's still probably only about 2/3 of the sales that at best, 2/3 of the sales that we had in the peak in 06. So there's still a long way to go, and those are jobs. That's people spending money. Really affects the economy here.
Yeah, it's a big driver in the economy. Sir, I want to go back to something that Calvin said earlier about urban sprawl. What do you think reforming CEQA will have? What impact will it have on urban sprawl?
Well, it depends on which particular reform you're talking about. There's a lot of reform.
Let's say major reform.
Okay. Well, major reform you're still talking about from those who are on the side of enforcing CEQA and those who are on the side of fighting CEQA and what they see as reform. I see. In terms of infill, though, I think that CEQA as it currently exists is most likely sufficient to increase infill or to support infill. I don't think it's as big of an obstacle as people are being led to believe by those who want to eviscerate CEQA. I think there are already some ways that you can get exemptions for infill. I think that the exemption provisions for infill can be improved a little bit to encourage infill in the San Joaquin Valley, because some of the conditions for exemption are better suited for really highly urbanized, highly dense communities like in the Bay Area and Southern California.
There was actually an amendment, SB 226, just 2 years ago,
yes.
That really allows for infill development and streamlining the CEQA process to kind of encourage that. Judy, let me go to you on air quality. One of the things that Sarah's mentioned is, you know, this large warehouse in Visalia and the impact that it might have on air quality, that, you know, Visalia got around CEQA by using an exemption. If CEQA standards are made a little less stringent, do you think that's going to impact air quality in the San Joaquin Valley? What do you think, Judy?
I think it probably would, although probably more so at the south end of the valley than at the north end of the valley, just because the air pollution problems are bigger down there.
So, Calvin, what do you think? In Bakersfield, is it going to have a big impact in Bakersfield if they make major changes to CEQA?
That's a loaded gun question.
I get to ask it. You get to answer it.
Yeah, I guess so. Really, the CEQA reforms that I've been hearing about, to be honest, I don't think will have much impact, on air quality issues. I think mostly it's procedural that we're looking at in this cycle, legislative cycle. I don't know that they're even looking at those types of reforms that would affect air quality. And I can say, almost with 100% assurance that I doubt very much in California that any CEQA change would be something that would promote worse air quality.
Okay. Well, let me ask you about this. Judy, let me ask you this question. Some people are saying that CEQA's piecemeal, incremental, project-to-project approach has replaced long-range comprehensive planning. Do you agree with that assessment?
I don't. I think the challenges for long-range comprehensive planning are other things at the moment, things like term limits for local council members, because everything cycling through every 8 years, new council members don't have a sense of that. I don't know that CEQA is fouling things up in terms of planning. And the other thing is, what we see up here is that our elected leaders sort of jump from issue to issue. So in 2006, traffic was the big concern. And then by 2009, the housing crisis, of course, was the big concern. And now they're talking about, if we just had more land for development. So CEQA is not driving any of those discussions. They're real economic-based.
Okay. Sarah, I want to ask you a question. Do you think CEQA has become a substitute for local planning and just a public forum for resisting the negative effects of growth and development?
Well, I think that CEQA has become a substitute in a sense because local agencies don't have the funding to be doing the long-term planning that they really need to do. A lot of the general plans that we're working under in the Valley date back to 1994. And to do a new general plan costs, in some instances, over $1 million. It's very expensive. But what happens with CEQA is that with each project that comes along, the developer is the one who's providing the payment for the studies that are being used to inform land use planning. So in that sense, CEQA is really being used in order to accomplish the planning that should be done with general plans and community plans that the counties can no longer afford to do.
Well, okay, up next, a discussion about the reform proposals being floated and what they might mean for the Valley. That conversation in a moment. This is the Matty Report, Valley Views Edition.
From News Talk 580 KMJ, this is the Matty Report, Valley Views Edition. Here is Mark Kepler.
Welcome back. So what are the costs and benefits that might accrue to the Valley as a result of CEQA reform? We're talking about the impact of CEQA reform on the Valley with three folks. Julie Sly is with the Modesto Bee. Sarah Hedgepeth Harris is a Fresno land use attorney. And Calvin Sneed is an environmental law attorney from Bakersfield. So, Calvin, we're going to start with you. There's been a lot of talk about this thing called the standards-based approach. And that's the idea that a project could not be challenged in court if it complies with an approved city or county general plan, if those plans have an approved environmental impact report and the project is consistent with the sustainable community strategy set forth in state law. That's a mouthful, but that's SB 375. So I just wanted to define the standards-based approach. It looks more and more likely that's probably not going to happen now, but what are your thoughts on the standards-based approach? Is that a good idea or a bad idea?
Well, like all of this, it's kind of a mixed blessing, and it depends on which agency is, you know, developing the environmental studies. But from the standpoint of just a, you know, does it comply or not, I think it's a great idea. In fact, the law really is that way now. If you have an approved general plan and your EIR, some element of your EIR, is in compliance with that general plan, it's very difficult to challenge it. I can't say that you can't challenge it. And I think that's how I read your question is, can it be completely exempt from a challenge? I think that would be a good thing, personally.
Yeah. Sarah, do you think this is what some people allege, that having CEQA on top of all these other requirements is just duplication of effort?
Well, it depends on what the purpose is. The purpose of an environmental impact report is to let the public and the elected officials know what this project is and what are going to be the consequences and the impacts of that project on the environment. The fact that some agency has a standard for measuring impact is helpful, but in the context of CEQA, it's something where you would say, all right, there's a certain agency that's responsible for this. Let's say, for instance, the Air Board. Okay, so it'll have this project will have this impact on air quality. The Air Board has standards for addressing this, and in doing so, they will do it in this way. So all the EIR really requires is that you explain what the impact is and how will this be reduced or mitigated or avoided. And if that's done by agency standards or mitigation measures, either way, it doesn't matter.
You know, Judy, I want to ask you a question. You're probably, as a reporter, work for the Modesto Bee, probably have strong feelings about this. What about the issue of increased transparency? The idea that those filing lawsuits must reveal their financial interests and who's paying their legal costs. What are your thoughts about that?
I love that idea because
I thought you might.
There's some very creative names of these new groups that just sort of materialize when there's a controversial project, and it is hard to find out. And often they use local citizens. Usually they use local citizens to make their case for them, and somehow it all gets muddied as to who's really behind it. So I think that's a real plus. It will reveal when you've got one corporation against another or union involvement or just all sorts of monkey business.
Calvin, is there any good reason to not have transparency or, you know, to keep things confidential or private?
You know, I can't think of one. You know, from the standpoint of transparency, I think it probably gives some confidence to the public. But in reality, most of these lawsuits are brought by professionals, and all the people that are involved with the CEQA process pretty much know who they are. So this is really more a matter of informing the public, I think, than, you know, letting the lawyers know what's going on. And I think sometimes it's a little, it kind of distracts from the actual intent of behind CEQA, you know, and some of the other issues that, you know, really need to be dealt with, like overregulation and the so-called junk science and bad legal decisions.
Sarah, what do you think?
I think this is a real boogeyman, and I find it really troubling. Number one, you have some First Amendment right here, and this is one of the things that's been used in avoiding transparency in political campaigns. There's a compelling interest for knowing who's buying the votes of elected officials. I don't think there's the same
That's
kind of compelling.
That's a pretty strong charge, though.
Well, but it's true. All you have to do is look at Rubio and see who's been paying, what he's been doing in terms of attacking CEQA, and now he has gone to work for Chevron. So, you know, that kind of transparency is important. In the case of CEQA petitioners,
just to be clear though, no one's alleging that at this point that Senator Rubio did anything inappropriate.
No, but he has been carrying the ball for Chevron, and I think it's very clear in what he's done from my perspective. But from my work as a petitioner's attorney, I can tell you few instances. I know of only one where we've gotten funding from a labor union for work that's been done. And in most cases, the people who are challenging projects have no money. And they have no money. So it's very difficult for the community to use CEQA in order to challenge a project.
Well, the thing is happening right now in Fresno with the trash situation, trash haulers. They're using CEQA as a way to stop the move from the city trash haulers to a private contractor, and that's being funded by unions. That's one example. But
I happen to be their attorney.
Oh, do you? Okay, we'll leave that.
And I know that they're not being funded.
Okay, well, let's leave it aside for a second. Let's go on to some of the reasons for CEQA review. You know, what about eliminating things like blight or aesthetics or impacts on private views as factors to consider in the CEQA review process? Sarah, what do you think about that?
Well, I don't see the reason for doing that, because all CEQA requires, all that has to be in the EIR is describe, will this project cause blight? And if so, is there something that can be done to reduce it? And if not, then you look at, you do a benefits and costs analysis. And that's why these things, aesthetics and blight, shouldn't be reduced
or
eliminated.
Calvin, let me ask you, though. Isn't blight kind of in the eye of the beholder?
Blight?
Or aesthetics? You know, aesthetics?
I guess it's like pornography. You know it when you see it. The problem with... But let's go back to the original question. I agree with... I think it was Sarah talking that, you know, really, these are well-vetted planning tools that need to be looked at. Blight is a real thing. And the CEQA process does help evaluate that. Aesthetics, impacts on private views. These so-called tertiary effects, impacts, do make sense, and they are a good thing, and it's one of the positive parts of CEQA. I would want to see that changed.
You know, Jude, let me ask you a question about special exemptions. You know, you've seen a special exemption for CEQA on, I think, the L.A. Stadium and a few other places. Some people are talking about having a special exemption for high-speed rail. What about just, instead of changing CEQA, just giving these limited exemptions for special projects?
Well, I think when the two examples you cited, Mark, those are special exemptions for, obviously, projects that are going to have a huge impact. So special exemptions become... so political. I mean, they're only put forward for the really big projects. I don't think that's, and I believe that CEQA needs some reforms, but I don't think that's the way to go, because I think it just thoroughly politicizes the process.
Calvin, what do you think? Do you think special exemptions are a good idea as opposed to reforming CEQA?
Well, in the context of something like the, the high-speed rail, no. But there are categorical exemptions that exist now in the regs, and those do help out. So it's kind of a mixed blessing. It depends on how deeply you go into the word special. Special exemption for rebuilding a school already exists, for example.
Okay, well, let me ask one last question. We've only got about a minute left in the segment, and that is, what about using alternative dispute resolution, like mediation, as opposed to litigation to resolve disputes? Do these things always have to be literally, in court? So I'll talk to the attorneys on this issue. Sarah, what do you think?
Well, CEQA already requires mediation. So it would be nothing new.
Is it used? Is it used?
There's a mandatory settlement conference that has to happen almost immediately after a petition is filed. So is it used effectively? It depends on what the balance of power is. If you have community and neighborhood community members on one side and a big developer on the other, it's kind of difficult to mediate.
Calvin, what if we put a little amendment to that and said, what about a special master, someone who has some authority, understanding in this area? Do you think that would help in terms of getting the parties to resolve the disputes instead of going to court?
In terms of mediating, you get success when both sides want to settle. When one side doesn't want to settle, mediation is frankly going to be a waste of everyone's time.
Yeah. Mandatory mediation doesn't seem to make a lot of sense.
As far as the special master approach goes, I couldn't agree more that that would be a good thing.
Okay, great. Well,
somebody with a knowledge of law and science, involved in the processes, I think it's really important.
All right, great. I'm sorry about cutting you off there, but we're out of time. I want to thank our guest, Sarah Hedgepeth Harris, Fresno land use attorney, Calvin Steed, an environmental law attorney from Bakersfield, and Judy Sly from the Modesto Bee. Thanks, all of you, for joining us. If you want to keep up to date with state and local politics, you can sign up for our free e-newsletter, The Maddie Daily, by just logging on to our website at maddieinstitute.org.
The Maddie Report Valley Views Edition is a public affairs partnership between KMJ Radio and the nonpartisan Maddie Institute, providing the Valley with valuable insight and analysis on important public policy issues.
This is Mark Kepler for The Maddie Report Valley Views Edition. Thanks for joining us.